This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. What a game at the Emirates. Eddie Nketiah's last-minute thigh-high prod wins it for Arsenal and keeps them 5 points clear at the top of the Premier League. Brilliant goals from Rashford and Saka. A game that felt like 20 years ago, except sadly, none of us are 20 years younger. There's a Haaland hat-trick to keep the pressure on. Meanwhile, at the bottom, a very sad trip to the East End for Everton. A limp defeat to West Ham leaves them joint bottom. Elsewhere, drones in Southampton, more Mitoma fun. Mudrick looks good and Palace hold Newcastle. Also today, frozen WSL pitches, no mention of Shrewsbury and Big Barry transfer rumours. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Robin Cowan, welcome.
Good morning, Max.
Charlie says, are Barney and Wilson still living together? That's a great question. Jonathan Wilson, hello.
Morning. Well, we're absolutely not, just to be clear. Hello. I have to say, yeah, Barney was a tremendous host, mate. I can't fault him at all. And we enjoyed it so much, we even met for a pint on Christmas Day.
Oh, that's lovely. Barney, would you echo those thoughts?
In terms of the question, I still feel that mentally some part of me is still living in that flat. There's definitely a bit of me that I left there. So it's a bit like the Vietnam War, you know. A month later, I'm still fighting it.
I was hoping it was more like Bert and Ernie. You two.
Or Morecambe and Wise. Yeah, that's what we wanted.
No, we were brutally efficient flatmates. Can you imagine like the levels of kind of, let's get this done, let's do this now. I thought we were extremely good. I could see a kind of future for us as kind of, you know, Bert and Ernie-like figures, definitely.
Let's start the Emirates. Arsenal 3, Manchester United 2. Simon says, who's taking the Barry questions? I.e., that was a good game at the Emirates, wasn't it, Barry? Robin, do you want to step up to the plate with that that tough one to begin with?
Sure, yeah, it was fantastic. Really great. Yeah.
This is actually more insight than we normally get from Barry.
From Barry. So, no, Robin. He usually just says, oh, fuck off or something. Yeah, I mean, it's just a really enjoyable game. And my main takeaway is that Arsenal are just so much fun and they believe in what they're doing. And I was just thinking back to, you know, the collapse last season at Spurs and when they, you know, they completely blew their chance of top four, and just the transformation since then is just, it's unbelievable. So Mikel Arteta and also everyone who sort of is part of that rebuild and backing him in what he wants to do, it deserves a lot of credit because it's just remarkable what they're doing this season.
And is it remarkable, Barney, how quickly Arteta has changed it? Or is it the sort of the right amount of time for him to have changed Arsenal into his vision?
Yeah, it's not been that quick. I think it is the right amount of time. I mean, there's something about that obsession and the sense of someone who completely lives every second of it. I often feel with football that sometimes just having a plan is a good plan. If it's a plan and everyone believes in it, then it's a plan that will work. And you can see that because plans move on and change so often. But he really does improve players, like we've seen that. What he's done with Martin Odegaard is fantastic. You know, someone who's obviously really talented, and he's found exactly the right way to make him work. I mean, he adores him, doesn't he? They're kind of very similar figures. And there's something about the obsession there that's really compelling in the middle of this kind of spectacle. People get annoyed by Arteta's kind of touchline antics, but I actually find it incredibly engaging. I mean, I've been off for 2 weeks. And I've really enjoyed watching football.
For the first time in how long?
perhaps for the first time. But as a spectator, I've really appreciated what an amazing product it is, how vivid it is, and how somehow, despite all the stuff you do to it, the Premier League's a ridiculous theatre, it still feels incredibly real and visceral. Maybe that's an illusion. It's kind of the spectacle, isn't it? You kind of worry about the spectacle, the society of the spectacle. We're kind of watching this thing and it just distracts us and keeps us kind of, consuming. And that's been a thing we've sort of spoken about with football for decades. But I now find, I sort of find it very refreshing. There's at least there's something real there. It does feel real. His feelings about it are real. The things he's doing are successful and satisfying and enjoyable to watch. And I found watching the Premier League sort of quite the spectacle as a distraction really quite refreshing. And that was just a brilliant game of football, really high end, with nothing fake or phony about it. And I really liked Erik ten Hag afterwards. I liked the way he spoke about the game and said, we will learn from this. I like the way he doesn't blame anyone. He doesn't go on about the referee. He's entirely serious about his job. And I kind of really like that about him. And sort of win or lose, he feels like someone who will fulfill that role with the dignity it deserves. And I just thought it was a really good game.
Did Arsenal deserve it, Wilson? I think they did. I looked at XG and a match that they've had two numbers for Arsenal, 2.93. And then a few minutes later, their XG had gone up to 3.16 at sort of 10:30 in the evening, which I thought was quite impressive. And Man United's was only 0.33. It felt much closer than that.
Yeah, it did. But I mean, Arsenal had a lot of chances that last 20 minutes or so. I don't know. I wrote about Eddie Nketiah sort of suggesting that he might be one of these figures who suddenly gets a couple of crucial goals in a title race, the shift of momentum. And so you think of somebody like Federico Makeda or from an Arsenal point of view, Christopher Ray or Martin Hayes, or going further back, you think of David Needham coming in at Nottingham Forest and scoring four goals in 77-8 as a centre-back. And then I sort of thought, maybe I'm being unfair on him because you know his goal scoring has never really been questioned. You know, I think he's the record goal scorer for England's under 21 side, for instance. And yet he is sort of a bit part player. Yesterday was the first day when his number of Premier League starts for Arsenal exceeded his age to 24 to 23. But then you think how fragile these things are. So with 6 minutes to go when he had that chance and De Gea saved it, I was thinking then, oh no, you know, he had that chance against Newcastle when Nick Pope made a very good save. Again, I don't know, in the final 10 minutes, I can't remember exactly when it was, but late on. And then what if, come the end of the season, Arsenal miss out on the title by 3 points or fewer, and there's 4 points they've left on the table because Nketiah's had effort saved. And you think, oh yeah, maybe he's just not quite precise enough with his finishing. But of course, that's absurd because he does score goals. He scored loads of goals. He's Arsenal's top goal scorer in all competitions this season. And then the fact he does get that winner, suddenly the narrative shifted completely from Nketiah not being quite a good enough backup to Jesus to Nketiah possibly being the slightly improbable bloke who won the title for them.
There were two absolutely stunning goals in this game, Robin, weren't there? Rashford and Saka. It's very hard. There's no need to decide which you prefer from those. But, you know, just two players sort of. You watch them both and the confidence that they both have, which is quite a hard thing to quantify or hard thing to like, how do you give that? I mean, both Arteta and Ten Hag deserve so much credit for giving those players that confidence to take on those opportunities.
Yeah, I feel like, especially for Rashford, because clearly he lost it for quite some time and now he's got it back. And just, I think I preferred Saka's finish just because it was almost like behind him and he's managed to get that power and the accuracy. But the sort of touch from Rashford around Partey was just, it's instinctive. And I think that's what happens when you've got that confidence that you just kind of, you don't even think about it. And then the way you just struck it low into the corner. I mean, it's just great to see both of them really enjoying their football. I know Saka obviously had that setback, you know, missing the penalty for England, but you know, who hasn't? So he probably will go through a dip in form like Rashford did, you know, because it's just, that's just life. But it's just great to watch and appreciate them both, and they both make massive contributions to their teams.
Yeah, Bunny, I thought Saka had no right to score from there, is what I thought. I mean, it was sort of a ridiculous finish.
Yeah, it was amazing, wasn't it? He kind of just got that tiny little step, half a step, and no backlift shot. He's just sort of adorable, isn't he? You have to like Saka. He's such a smart, nice kind of guy. And it's great that people can exist in football as someone like he has since the age of six and still emerges these. I feel the same about Eddie Nketiah as well. They're really likeable. But, you know, they have the Arsenal thing that they've created is impossible not to feel it's a good thing because they have these homegrown players. Eddie Nketiah is sort of a local hero for me. He used to play for Hilly Fielders, who my sons played for as well, who are basically a park team. And he, I think, grew up on the Honor Oak Estate, which is where, or very close to there, which is where Ian Wright and David Rocastle came from. In fact, there's a Rocastle Road there now. And so there's something, even though it's South East London, there's something deeply Arsenal about him. There's the deep soul of modern Arsenal seems to kind of express itself through Nketiah. And that is one of the reasons why fans and managers and everyone sort of connects has kind of wanted him to succeed and why that bond has kind of stayed there. And he's clearly a very hardworking, kind of nice kid. And seeing the two of them together on television after the game, you kind of thought, how have they managed to retain this innocence and this kind of, you know, this just such a sort of agreeable, nice people. The great thing about Saka is his relentlessness. So I really like, he's a very modern player. Like he just keeps coming and keeps, imagine what it must be like to defend against him. Because he can dribble, he can shoot, he's a really good passer in tight areas, and he just keeps going. His stamina is great, and he will just wear you down. He's a perfect Arteta player. Him and Odegaard have gone from being really talented players to really outstanding match-winning players this season, and that's two players fitting the system perfectly.
And Odegaard Wilson did that. I think Matty's been in touch to call it an Elastico through ball. What he did with his feet for Xhaka, who didn't quite get onto it, was kind of miraculous.
Yeah, well, he's another one of these players who, I mean, I guess it's not quite the same as Rashford, but you feared that he'd lost it, or that maybe in his case he never quite had it, that he was overhyped, too young, and you sort of thought, I mean, obviously huge different backgrounds, but you thought, could he be some kind of Freddie Adu figure who we all knew about far too early, before it's fair to have any expectations of somebody. And yet now we're seeing just what an extraordinary player he is. That, and it's not just he's supremely technically gifted. He's obviously got just an incredible football brain that he sees spaces. And yeah, the thing I most admire Messi for is his capacity always to choose. Yeah, Messi can do anything with the football, essentially. But he's got this capacity to choose the lowest tariff necessary thing in any given circumstance, which makes it more likely to come off. And I sort of think something similar about Odegaard. He makes the game at times look very, very simple. It looks like he doesn't really do anything complicated. And yet he does have that ability to do extremely difficult things as well.
So look, Arsenal 5 points clear. They've got a game in hand. Of course, those two games between Arsenal and City. They also play each other on Friday night in the FA Cup. Let's go to the London Stadium for the rest of part one. West Ham 2, Everton 0. Jim says, are you going to record the pod as if Frank Lampard has already been sacked in order to save time in doing an insert once he gets sent packing after the mics are switched off? I thought Wilson, with his kind of stubble and beanie, he looks a bit like Phil Mitchell after. I don't know what stage of Phil Mitchell we're in at the moment. I've sort of lost, you know, maybe he's living really well and running the pub or the garage, but maybe he's been chucked out by Sharon and is sleeping in his car. And Lampard, who's normally so clean cut, gave the air of Phil Mitchell to me.
I mean, this is clearly a much less dramatic statement, but the person he's starting to look like is his dad.
That is true.
It was one of the things that I kind of... Yeah, I for a long time I couldn't really see that Frank Lampard Senior and Frank Lampard Junior. They didn't seem a natural match. You can't see a kind of family likeness, but now you absolutely can. In the same way that Jamie and Harry Redknapp, but doesn't seem to be any sort of familiar likeness.
But in 30 years, what would Jamie Redknapp? You know, who knows?
But Frank Lampard, with the pressure of partly age, but also the pressure of management, is starting to look increasingly like his dad. I mean, I don't know. Will they get rid of him? I just don't think, of all the issues at Everton, I just don't think he's the biggest at the moment. I think he is an issue. I think there's a lot to doubt about his management. You know, the two goals on Saturday came from the classic Lampard sources of a set play and a counter-attack. The two things that he's never been able to defend in his managerial career. But I just think there's so much else wrong at Everton that, yeah, getting rid of Lampard... It's almost sort of doing something for the sake of doing something.
I mean, isn't having a terrible board the best thing that's ever happened to Frank Lampard? It's become this binary thing. Is Lampard the problem or is the board the problem? Well, you know, maybe they're both not very good. And the board appointed Lampard. It's like the kind of nature and nurture idea. Nurture is nature. There's no difference. Nature affects nurture. There is no other thing.
Well, I guess my point is, who would come in who would be obviously good?
Oh, loads of people. A 30-year-old German in a checkered sports coat wearing maroon trousers who's has a small beard. And you've never heard of him, but, well, you probably have heard of him, but he's really organised. He knows loads of good players. And, you know, a guy like that, well, anyone will come in and do a good job. I don't, you know, Gary Rowett would come in and do a better job. He just has, I mean, Wilson, you're probably on the Lampard payroll, you know, someone who's so much in football. He has so many friends. I saw on Match of the Day, because I now watch, experience all football through Match of the Day. He's got no goal scorers. It's not his fault. Someone or other was saying he's got no goal scorers. Well, I mean, why has he got no goals? They spent a lot of money. Last summer they bought Neil Mopay, Dwight McNeil, and they brought Dele Alli in under Lampard. Well, are they goal scorers? You know, who he's got two central defenders and two defensive midfielders in. Dominic Calvert-Lewin stopped scoring under Lampard. Whose fault is it they have no goal scorers? I mean, why does he always get a pass? It's always someone else's fault. I don't think, you know, things change very quickly in football with a few good results. And while I really like the Everton banners that say things like, you've no philosophy, no vision, you know, they're annoyed that the club doesn't have a set of slogans and a kind of marketing plan. I kind of agree with them in that Lampard is just part of that thing. And, you know, he's an expression of a really clueless board, and they're both part of the same problem. He's obviously not a very good manager, although he is good at speaking and he looks good on camera, and he danced around with great happiness after they avoided the relegation he almost inflicted on them. And that's endeared him to the fans. He seems human and approachable, and as though he does have a slogan and a philosophy. And he's something to cling to, but I can't see. It's amazing. They've lost to all the teams around them, and yet he's still in the job for now.
I think I agree with Barney that, like, mainly it's just they're in such a terrible run. Usually I'm not sort of someone who says, well, that's going to solve everything, obviously, and it won't for Everton. But he can't stay on. He just can't. And I'm going to put forward a gravelly-voiced, flame-haired, goateed
Sean Dyche.
If you don't, yeah. Jonathan, if they don't want to concede from counter-attacks and set pieces, I'm saying.
Yeah, that's true. And maybe Everton fans have now reached the point that they accept a Dyche in the way they didn't accept an Allardyce.
Allardyce.
and Barney's right. That pretty much the only type of manager they haven't tried is the maroon-trousered 30-year-old German. But that's my sort of fear for them. That they've pretty much gone through every sort of manager. That they've had Koeman, they've had Allardyce, they've had Ancelotti, they've had
Marco Silva.
So Marco Silva, I know he's not German, but he is of that sort of,
yeah, he's of the in the German style.
He's of that young Euro.
They haven't tried mature, well-respected Spanish. You know, Lopetegui, kind of Emery.
I mean, Ancelotti's borderline on that, though, isn't he?
No, he's kind of, overlord friend to the stars. He was too high. They went too high there. They went with kind of Galactico's friend.
Right, okay.
You need hardworking, angry, mid-range Spanish.
Benitez?
An attempt at that, but I think he'd gone by then.
Yes. I was just thinking there, surely, you know, Benitez was definitely there. It just took me a second. It just took me a second. I wondered about, you know, they signed Tarkowski and Cody. And sort of universally, everyone said that is brilliant. They are two brilliant signings. They're, you know, good, solid centre-backs. They're great people. They're excellent in the dressing room. But I just wonder if actually they have been good. I mean, are they good? It feels criminal. It seems like you can't say that they're not good signings because I haven't heard anyone say...
Or good people. Are you saying they're not very nice? They're bad in the dressing room.
Oh, they're definitely good in the dressing room. There's no way they can't be good in the dressing room. Yeah. They're poison.
Snakes.
Cody's poison in the dressing room.
they
feels unlikely.
The thing with both of them is they're very good sort of physical defenders who you can trust to chuck their bodies in the way of things. And I think that did give them a short-term boost. I just think modern defending is about more than that. I mean, obviously having people who chuck themselves in the way of shots is never a bad thing. But ideally, you'd be stopping that before the opposition has a chance to have a shot. Your structure in your organisation would be good enough that you'd halt that higher up the pitch. I'm not saying Cody and Tarkowski can't play in that kind of system. But at the minute, they're sort of defending. Every game, I sort of feel Everton play like they're a third-flight club playing a Premier League club in the FA Cup. And then, you know, they might get something because they try really hard. And they might bundle a goal in, and they might chuck the body in the way of enough shots, and that might get them enough results. And that kind of got them out of relegation last season. But it's not really a long-term solution. And once confidence starts to go and you start circling around the plug hole, I think that becomes less and less effective.
A lot was made, Robin, of not all the Everton players going to applaud the fans after the game. And I did think, clearly it's sort of, you know, it's like what you have to do. It's like lesson one on after a defeat, you have to go. But I was thinking, if it was me and I had the choice of going towards sort of thousands of people who really didn't like me and were yelling at me to sort of clap at them or not, I probably wouldn't. I mean, Barry and I on the radio were discussing kind of what could you bend your run, like a sort of like trying to stay on side. Like, how close do you have to get? As long as you went past the dugout and you look like you're going there, but you don't actually, you could be 40, 50 yards away and still, they could still in the pub say, well, at least he went up, at least Max went up and did applaud us.
I think so. I think,
you know, credit him.
Maybe a Sunday league ref style, just stay in the centre circle. As long as you're seen to applaud, do you have to get that close? Although I suppose fans have a sort of, there might be a sort of sliding scale of respect of how close you get.
True.
But then, then you get Yerry Mina, you know, out in the car park having a conversation, and that's proper. That is like top level. So,
that's amazing respect.
Exactly.
For him for doing
and the main
that.
Thing. I thought that you were going to say that a lot was made of Jared Bowen having twins, which made me. I know probably yourself as well, Max, as a sort of new parent, made me absolutely shudder with.
Can
word.
You imagine? Yeah. One is so many. It's lucky he didn't score four, isn't it? It's lucky he didn't, you know, because it was dependent on the number of goals he scored, the number of children he had. Barney, we should mention West Ham. That was a pivotal result for them, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, I was kind of felt they'd probably be okay. They played three at the back, which was a change, and David Moyes being flexible and out-tacticking, well, as the result seems to suggest, Frank Lampard. You know, they'll kind of be fine. He kind of went back to, it's good to see Mikel Antonio and Jared Bowen, who, you know, their best attacking players driving that win. And David Moyes doing his smile afterwards, you know, when he does that slightly uncomfortable smile in front of the camera. He's obviously had some media training where they said, David, the problem is you're a bit dour. People say dour, Dave. So smile. And he does the thing of TV producer. You know, when you go on those nodding head programs where they get you to talk about like bands in the 90s or football stuff that have Gazza's tears. The producer often sits on the other side of the camera. You must have seen, you know, TV, and smiles at you with a really weird fake smile.
TV. Yeah.
So that you smile. They do this weird kind of look of like baring their teeth at you. and that seems to be the David. But, you know, I'm kind of pleased with it. The one thing that David Moyes always surprises me, he's really brutal on his players. He said, the problems we've had this season, you know, over the summer, we tried to just bring in some better players and that's caused a few problems. Okay, if you're one of his players watching that, managers can be very, I think they sometimes forget that people can hear them and that those bad players can hear him.
Have you ever had to do noddies yourself, Barney? When occasionally I did local BBC News, and you know, we'd only have one camera, so I'd interview, you know, the local councillor, and then I'd have to do 2 minutes of just nodding along so they could get some edit points in. So it's sort of surreal. How you know, that's when you sort of think, what is this? Is totally TV is totally ridiculous. Just nodding for no apparent reason.
Well, especially because everybody knows now how it works. So when you see someone nodding, you think, they filmed that 40 minutes later in a motorway cafe.
Exactly, yeah. It would be better if they weren't even in the same room.
It was extraordinary. I can't remember where I saw this, but they were talking about sound effects on early sport. So for instance, when you watch horse racing on telly, that's not the horses you hear. It's,
is that some coconuts?
No, yeah. It's 50 men with coconuts going, no, it's stampeding bison. In early cricket commentary, the noise of the ball on the bat was somebody with a pencil on the desk. And yeah, they had to get people who were really good at timing it. And there was, I can't remember what the noise of a dart going into a board is. It's, hang on, let me Google this.
It's a very nice noise. It's very satisfying.
Yeah, but it's not. It's
a lovely
noise. But it's not the noise of a dart going into a board.
I was thinking with the cricket, you know, would there be like an IPL of pencil tappers. You know, so like obviously as the game builds, so does the pencil tapping. You could make millions if you were, you know, if you said, I'm Rohit Sharma. So like I'm the pencil hitting that for that batsman. I can do Joss Butler really well. Have you found it, Wilson?
Yeah, well, I found a thing that says it's a dustbin falling over or a sample of a bass drum. But then I've also found somebody saying, so Dave Allen, head of media for the PDC, says that in the modern age, there are four holes in the dartboard that have microphones in them to pick up the sound behind the 20, the 19, the 6, and the 11. So if people listen carefully, they can hear the difference between a treble 20 and a double 18. But yeah, in the old days, it was either a drum sample or a bin falling over.
Like, keep dropping a bin. Anyway, listen, we've got quite a lot of football to discuss, so we should probably end this part now. Back in a second. Hi, Pod fans. Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Man City 3, Wolves 0. Wilson, you wrote a piece about Haaland and Man City's system before the game. Just because a striker is prolific, just because he's obviously a great player, does not mean he's making the team better. He went on to score a hat-trick, 16th of his career. He's got more goals than the Golden Boot winner of the last four seasons. Was he proving your point?
I mean, there's no point to be proved. You know, my point was merely that you can't think because you've got a striker scoring, you know, the preposterous rate he is, that the team is necessarily better. So at the halfway point in the season, City had scored 50 goals and conceded 20. Last season, in total, they scored 99 and conceded 26. So goals for hasn't really changed, and goals against is a lot worse. And that is exactly what you'd expect to happen, because you have to play more direct to Haaland, and so you can't play the pass to let you get set up to counter-attack. And also, I think the game at Old Trafford this season, so the game a week on Saturday, compare that to the equivalent game last season, which City won 2-0, yeah, very, very comfortably, could have been 4 or 5-0. Haaland, depending which stats you look at, had either 19 or 20 touches. And the lowest number of touches by a City outfield player last season in that game was 71. So if you're trying to control the game through possession and one of your players is having, you know, essentially a quarter of the touches of the lowest touching ball player last season, that clearly makes a big difference how you play. Now, that tension may be productive. Creative tensions often are. It may be that Haaland's goal scoring is what carries them over the line in those European games they've been losing. But equally, it has meant that defensively, they're not as secure as they were, and they're even more vulnerable to balls played in behind the defensive line, which was always there. Yeah, you know, if you're picking a flaw in a Guardiola side, that was always the flaw, and I think it's made the flaw wider. So I think it's a really interesting gamble, was the point of the piece, rather than necessarily saying it's a bad idea or it's a good idea. It's just these are the issues that bringing in something like that creates.
I can only work on that binary level, good or bad. I can't see nuance, of course.
If you look at big goal scorers, I mean, Ronaldo, I was really surprised by this. Ronaldo, Brazilian Ronaldo, his goals per game record before the knee injuries is pretty much a goal a game in the 90s when nobody scored at a goal a game. Yet he didn't win the league until 2002. Yeah, he'd been playing 8 years before he won a league title. You look at Eduard Streltsov, who I think, certainly in terms of his physical domination, has a lot of similarities to Haaland. That, you know, he feels like almost like a different species. He's just bigger and faster than everybody else, and technically also at an extremely high level. And the two sort of big coaches he had, Viktor Maslov and Nikolai Morozov, both of them clearly had massive doubts about how useful Streltsov was.
Like, you just narrow it down. Where are we? Hungary in the 40s? I don't know.
There are obviously two key points of reference here, Brazilian Ronaldo and Edward Streltsov. I mean, could you give us a hint as to anywhere we could find out a bit more about? Is there anywhere, any resource we could find out more about Edward Streltsov?
Well, it's funny you should mention that. But I mean, I wrote a novella about Streltsov, which I think tries to explore the emotional truth of him, or you could look at Behind the Curtain, which is more of a, there's a section there that goes into the history of it. So yeah, they would be the two places I'd refer you to.
Can I have some opinions about this as well?
Please do.
Briefly,
yeah.
Sorry. I agree with Jonathan. I wrote, I mean, it's obviously really interesting. You know, it's just basically very, City fans get very touchy about this, but it's really interesting. You have a team and a manager who's made a massive virtue of not having that kind of player, who's essentially pioneered this idea of always having overloads, and the extra man who isn't a goal scorer being the key to your team, has now signed the most strikerish striker since strikers became...
Since Edward Streltsov.
It's obviously very interesting of how that's going to work. And if you are not interested in it, you wouldn't like football. So, and obviously there's going to be a period of adjustment. But what's interesting, while I agree that you have to understand that they're essentially trying to learn this new system on the hoof. So to have got close to the perfectly groove, he's been there 5 years last season, and they played with three players who were false nines throughout the season. It was really quite a fascinating way of winning the league. To be functioning at all while it's going through these teething stages is pretty impressive. But then again, talent plus some of the best players in the world is hardly a plucky underdog story. But they will go through the gears on it, and this isn't the finished product. And also, we do criticise managers for not changing. That's the thing people say about Klopp, isn't it? He's still essentially playing the same system, and the best players at Liverpool are the players who always were the best players at Liverpool. Whereas Guardiola is trying, you know, this is his midlife crisis. This is his red Mazda MX-5. You know, he's doing something different. And that is interesting. He remains interesting. He remains tactically interesting. I'm not sure how tactically interesting Jurgen Klopp is right now, whereas Guardiola, I'm still fascinated by what he's going to do with this team, even though, yes, it involves buying someone who is obviously the world's best goal poacher and being able to throw money at the problem. You know, the game is so resilient that even that is interesting.
So basically, Haaland is weirdly similar surname, Izzy Hoyland, to Guardiola's Carl Kennedy.
Yes, that is true. Although Izzy Hoyland was, I mean, because Sarah was probably his midlife crisis. And then Izzy Hoyland was that was even after.
Sarah was just a fling, though. Izzy Hoyland, he actually a full-blown relationship.
No, that's true. So. Yeah, no, that is a good point. Oh, well, I'll check with him.
Sarah's Latin.
Yeah, okay, Sarah's Latin. Yeah.
And Hoyland is Haaland, as the names would suggest.
And who's Susan, then? Who's Susan?
Oh, that
De Bruyne.
Any false nine. Any
all the
false
nines. All that chap who sits next to Pep, who I should know who it is, but I don't know. He sort of resembles Baron Greenback slightly. Let's rattle through a few more of the games then. Leicester 2, Brighton 2. Barney, how much do you enjoy Mitoma?
Yeah, he's great, isn't he? He what a mover, you know. I like the way he, when Solly Marsh missed that, I think his standing leg slipped and he kind of ballooned the ball while I was over the bar. I mean, some of it just looked really, really sad to see a human doing something so messy. And, you know, he's so neat and perfect in the way he moves around. But I was really surprised to see, I thought Leicester were going to win that game. And it seemed kind of odd. Like losing to Leicester it just seems like something you shouldn't do. It's a void, or it's a weakness. It's like forgetting, it's like oversleeping or something. You think, well, how have I done that? Or letting a pan of milk boil. It's something really annoying that you shouldn't have done. You really should be beating them. You know, Brendan looks sad. He always looks like he's standing on the hard shoulder in the rain, waiting for his breakdown. He's still hopeful, but it's dark now and he's cold. And, you know, I watched the game. The only notes I've actually made is that De Zerbi looks like a street magician on YouTube. Like he's going to make a snooker ball disappear. I mean, I love his energy and I love the way he's immediate. It shows that, Graham Potter obviously left a squad of intelligent, sort of, you know, young players with room for improvement there. And that's been such a good fit. And it does show the difference between a well-run club and a not well-run club. You're thinking of Everton, you know, the contrast is so stark. And it doesn't seem that difficult. It doesn't seem that difficult to think, well, we need a manager a bit like Graham Potter, who's, you know, just a bit of research, a bit of Googling. Surely you'd come up with a De Zerbi type figure. But it's really nice to see their energy, and I do enjoy watching them.
You mentioned Brendan Rodgers being stuck on the hard shoulder. I mean, he's yet to start looking like Frank Lampard Sr. So there's different levels, aren't there, of sort of how much he's struggling. But it was a great call to a radio show. I think Paul Hawksby was telling me about it, where it was sort of like, you know, there were Tottenham fans who would never buy a JVC telly, right? Because it was sponsored Arsenal, you know, and Arsenal fans wouldn't drink Holston pills. And there was an Aston Villa fan who was broken down on the side of the road with his family with a smashed windscreens. And they'd been waiting for 2 hours in the rain. And then someone from Auto Windscreens came up and he went, nope, can't. they sponsored Birmingham City. I'm not having that fixed. We should talk about Evan Ferguson, Wilson. I don't know how much you know about him, apart from he seems to be very Irish, so he's not going to be stolen like Grealish and Declan Rice.
No, he is going to be stolen. He is, yeah.
No, he can be, yeah. He's eligible, yeah, yeah.
Oh, well, are we going to steal him? Oh, poor Barry.
My understanding is that he is committed to Ireland, but he absolutely is.
That is the dream, isn't it, to field an 11 of Irishmen in the England team. That is the dream.
But, I mean, he's so Irish. I mean, like, that's like, it's just, you know, Owen Morgan was incredibly successful. It's a slightly different comparison, but, yeah, I'd be delighted. He looks like a brilliant centre-forward, actually, and that was an absolutely fantastic header, wasn't it? Bournemouth 1, Forest 1. Robin, do you have any big thoughts on this football match? I was pleased for Sam Surridge because he'd missed bucket loads of chances in the last sort of 2 weeks and he kept at it.
Yeah, I just really like Forrest. I think, you know, again, just really impressed with Steve Cooper, and especially I think Gibbs White and Brennan Johnson have really formed a really good partnership. They've got, I mean, I think they're 15th or something. I mean, they were... Towards at the beginning of the season, they were just shockingly bad. And then that Manchester United defeat when they came back from the World Cup. And but no, I think, yeah, Steve Cooper's shown that he's an excellent coach, despite, again, I'm sure they'll have more players thrown at him between now and the end of the transfer window. We'll see.
Actually, Bournemouth, Jay Nancy took their goal brilliantly. The first touch, absolutely brilliant. And the cross was from this new player, Ouattara. And when he was signed, his sort of handshake photo with one of the Bournemouth hierarchy, forgive me, I'm not sure who it is. He's wearing a shirt that's clearly just been taken out of its
package. Oh, yeah.
It's got the sort of unironed squares. So it begs the question, what was he wearing before that they thought we have to put, what could he be wearing that meant we can't have that in the photo? Anyway, they did very well. Drone stopped play at St Mary's, Barney, which is possibly the most interesting part of this game.
Yeah, a drone inside the stadium. And Jonathan Pearce wasn't even there. Sorry. yeah, that was weird, wasn't it? There seems to be a thing about drones that if you see a drone, you have to panic. Do you remember when they shut, I think, you know, one of the London airports, because there was a drone hovering nearby. And you think, well, okay, is that...
No, but I think there actually wasn't a drone. I think it was a false sighting. Wasn't that the issue? And then
it's a false drone. A false drone is what Pep would prefer.
Yeah, you're right. There wasn't a drone. There was talk of a drone, and that was enough.
For like 48 hours around Christmas, yeah. But I get it, because like a drone, like as we've seen in Ukraine, they can be loaded with explosives, so you've got to be very careful. A drone flying towards a stand full of 10,000 people is potentially extremely dangerous.
Well, that's taking the mood down, but I mean, you are right.
I haven't really thought of that, I suppose. I mean, it's an unlikely, yeah.
And there was that Serbia-Albania game when the drone came down with the flag that led to that on-pitch brawl. Nick Ames was there, of course.
I remember there was a competition on the radio where we were giving away... we were giving away like TVs and drones. And at that time, drones, to my mind, they weren't like, you know, things that people just shoved up in the sky just to look at. They were just weapons. I was like, what next? Giving away Scud missiles? Seems like an inappropriate competition.
Have you got, Max, do you have a drone? People do.
I don't have a drone.
People who've got drones, and both of them are kind of slightly on the kind of, it's interfering with your DNA spectrum.
Football Weekly at theguardian.com if you own a drone. And but no, I don't have one. I wonder, Robin, if Ollie Watkins afterwards, he said, I obviously always loved playing with Danny Ings and it's a shame he's gone. He's a great lad. Was thinking, I've seen off Danny Ings in the Watkins-Ings debate.
Yeah, I think he was like, yeah, well, we're well shot of him, actually. That was a really interesting bit of business because I think Danny Ings actually was their top scorer, but clearly Watkins maybe offers just something slightly different and more something that Unai Emery prefers. I thought the Southampton disallowed goal, not the offside one, was very, very soft. And I know it probably is right. He just stood on the back of his foot. I just thought, come on.
Yeah. I did like Jacob Ramsey afterwards saying, look, it's one of those where...
he even said that, yeah.
He sort of said it's one of those where, you know, there's a question. Should you go down? Should you not go down? Is there enough contact? I'm like, surely you're not meant to have that debate. You're the person going down. Like, we have that debate. You just... So he obviously, in that split second, thought, well, it's a debatable one, so I'll give it a go.
Well, there was that, and there was the... was it Welbeck at Leicester? And I think the foul on Welbeck was much clearer than that.
I think
foul.
The one about Welbeck was because they're running in. If he'd been running after him and tripped him over, it would have been obviously a foul. But because it's sort of running at a different, he's running in different directions.
Well, there's only one angle where I was totally convinced, and it was sort of a player in the way. But you just saw when he paused it, when they paused it on telly.
Well, you did. You just admitted you paused the TV and looked at, Wilson pauses the TV and looks at fouls.
Does that include the drone Venn diagram as well? People who pause, zoom in.
And you could just see it beyond the defender's leg.
Yeah, the moment's gone now, Wilson. No one cares. that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll round up the rest of the games. I don't think there are any goals in any of them. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly, the 0-0 zone we enter. Start at Anfield. Liverpool 0, Chelsea 0. Was this a terrible game, Wilson? What was this? Was it an all right game?
It was an okay game. The first half was pretty poor. I thought it picked up second half. And Mudrick coming on was interesting. Again, I was sort of with Nketi. You sort of think, if Arsenal had signed Mudrick, Nketi probably wouldn't have been on the pitch to score the winner. That Mudrick would have come on and probably would have been Nketi who made way, and maybe Martinelli moved in the middle. So the contingency of these things exists. Mm. But Mudrick looked really lively, really quick, really good on the ball. I think there's a lot to be excited about. The only slight doubt, and look, this is it's a tiny doubt, and he's still, what age is he, 21, 22? So he's still very young. And his first game in a new country. But he's only scored 12 goals in his career. And that's my doubt about him. How has he only got that? You know, I know he's only played 39 games now, 38 games, something like that.
That's all right, isn't it, for an attacking midfielder?
It's all right, but I sort of think if you play in the Ukrainian league, you might like to have got a few more. And he had two decent chances on Saturday.
But he has the first one he's fashioned for himself in a really beautiful way, though, hasn't he?
Yeah, but then having got through, I think he slightly panics and sort of slashes at the shot when it needed a dink. I think a calmer presence in that moment.
A Ziyech or a Pulisic or a Hudson-Odoi or a...
Or a Sterling, yeah. I mean, Chelsea got loads of this type of player who panic when they get a chance. And then there was the long crossfield ball from the right that came to him and he tried to control it. I think probably he needed to take that first time. So that's my one tiny quibble about him, he doesn't seem yet to have that clarity that will bring the goals that you probably would want from him.
Do you think he's quicker than James Milner, Barney?
Well, everybody thinks they're quicker than James Milner until they get a 2 foot around the knees, as Mike Tyson once said. Now, Milner's actually, for his age, pretty quick, but he does know how to deal with a Mudrik when he sees one. When I like this game, there was sort of thing, nil-nil televised draws, but I like those kind of games. They feel like, you know, safe. I know where I am with it. It's like the game, it feels like it's heading towards a winner. It's nil-nil. So it feels like there's a narrative here. There's going to be a moment of crisis, a hero, and that it just doesn't. It's nil-nil. Football's difficult. I think we need them. They're solid filler. And I like
that. I like the all new Barney likes all types of football. I mean, this is perhaps you should not. Maybe you just shouldn't do any. Just tell the Guardian you just can't do any more work.
Yeah. I have more value as a kind of pontificating, self-satisfied kind of. I should be puffing on a pipe saying everything's good. It's all nice.
Yeah, absolutely right.
Yeah.
I think that's a definite niche for that. I would listen to that. Barney, if that's, you know, if that's the direction you choose to take your life in, I will follow.
Well, it's definitely easier, yeah. And fewer people hate you.
Eventually, there would be the backlash, though. I'm so fed up of this man with the pipe just telling me everything's great. It isn't great.
Yeah, it's true. Have an opinion. Like, it's not great. Like, yeah.
Any other thoughts on this game, Robin, or can I take you to Crystal Palace nil, Newcastle nil, in which... Nick Pope made an absolutely amazing save, didn't he, from Mateta late on. Newcastle probably should have won the game.
But... Yeah, well, that was pretty much it. That was the game, wasn't it?
Yes, it was very much a Barry question for you there. There's no way you can go with it. I'm sorry.
That was an amazing save. I mean, it's just Newcastle's incredible defensive record is sort of kept intact. 11 goals in 20 games they've conceded. And yeah, I think it's been pointed out before, Eddie Howe, that was not his strong point when he was Bournemouth manager. So yeah, just very impressive. Very impressive from them.
Bemused Bagel says, was Newcastle's relative free scoring in mid-season a blip? They started the season unable to score. They've reverted back. Did Almiron's form hide a serious deficiency, Wilson?
Up to a point, yeah. But I guess, you know, it's still early in the project. I think getting the defence right makes sense. I think particularly given Eddie Howe's reputation, the fact that his Bournemouth side conceded 66 goals a season over 5 seasons they're in the Premier League, focusing on that makes sense. I mean, they've had 6 nil-nil draws this season in the league, which obviously is not great if you're looking to push beyond finishing fourth or you know wherever they end up. But I thought this game was very similar to the Fulham game where I think Newcastle were the better team, and had Newcastle won it 1-0, you wouldn't have thought anything particularly outrageous had happened. And yet at the same time, they could easily have lost it. And if they had lost those two games 1-0, then maybe be starting to have doubts. But they've taken 4 points in the two games, and that's fine. I mean, I think they will finish top four now. I don't think they're ever realistically making a title challenge. They're sort of on the fringes of that race, but... You sort of feel that's sort of slightly slipping away now, but they should be top four, which is in itself a great achievement.
If you can hear a train beeping or honking, they beep as much as honk, they trains. It's because I'm broadcasting from the garden, which is, I'm not trying to show off here because the weather is nice.
But it does look spectacularly Australian, which is why I think I was thinking of Carl Kennedy earlier.
It's in what, there's a koala bear like... just sort of on a branch.
But are those eucalyptus trees? Because if they're not, they should be.
I mean, I don't know. No idea.
There's a sort of New England feel as well, the clapboard side of the house. It's, you know, I feel like I'm speaking to kind of a young Kennedy. You know,
not that Kennedy, a different Kennedy. Yeah. The two famous Kennedy dynasties. Who was more important for the world? It's very hard to tell.
They meet in Max Rushton.
Leeds nil, Brentford nil, Barney. I mean, did you love this? Well, you love all football, of course. So
yeah, as someone who loves, I did enjoy. I mean, I always like enjoy watching Leeds because they're very energetic. And Jesse Marsh, you know, I'm obsessed with Jesse Marsh. I just like watching him walk on the pitch at the end in a coat, looking kind of noble and urgent, and like there's some vital point he has to make, which will make everyone feel great. I also enjoyed the match of the day segment again on this, where I felt like I was watching like Martin Keown's YouTube channel, where he talks the truth, anti-fake news. He was talking about, he used the word, I wrote them down, delusional, propaganda, baloney, and codswallop. which are interesting words. Baloney, obviously, that's a kind of Americanism from the sort of 50s, which presumably that was deliberate to as a nod towards Marsh. And codswallop, you know, that's some kind of old English, isn't it? It's something old Norse, possibly. but he brought all these words together, and I felt like I'm going to be taken off air any second, but I'm telling you the truth. And he should, I mean, you know, if he ever gets desperate, he could maybe look into that kind of thing, you know, contributions, or a GB News kind of role. He could be one of those presenters, because I felt that he had ripped the mask from my eyes on Jesse Marsh in that moment. And that I finally saw through the
What had Jesse Marsh said to turn Martin Keown into Mike Graham?
Well, he talks about we're learning, you know, we're on a journey. And you know, the Jesse Marsh things, you know, it's all, I see a lot of progress. We're going to become a good team. We're not a good team now, but we're going to become a good team. And there was a lot of spin and stuff that Jesse Marsh is very good at. Like if he had a 7-stage motivational series of CDs that I could buy and listen to in the car on the way to meetings, I would buy them and listen to them all the time.
Wow. Do you have a 7-CD changer in your car?
No, but I would get one, and it would probably be a Mondeo, and I'd sit on the hard shoulder, weeping as I listened to Jesse Marsh telling me to feel better about myself. But I just felt that Keown brutally, he ripped it away, you know, and I thought, wow, this is a man I could follow. I could follow him. Whatever he said, I would follow it. And you don't often get that from a very brief punditry stint.
Joe says, how have Tottenham ruined their fans' weekend by not even playing? Simon says, are the current goings-on at Spurs attributable to a witch's curse? Look, it is Fulham Spurs tonight. We'll have more time on Wednesday's pod to talk about them in detail, by which time who knows what will have happened. Nicky is also on Wednesday, so we'll cover the Juve story, the 15-point penalty for false accounting, and the bans for Agnelli and Paratici, etc., 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 on Wednesday. Robin, you managed to see 7 minutes of Chelsea-Liverpool in the WSL. How was it?
It was a shame because I really thought that was one of the best commentaries. You know, I think maybe I'm better in bite-sized bunch chunks now. It was complete farce. We got there and everyone was saying it's dangerous, they shouldn't be playing this. They had a big tent with canisters pumping hot air onto the pitch, which was fine. But then as soon as they take this massive tent off, it froze over. It shouldn't have
started. Should have kept the tent on, shouldn't they? Kept the tent.
Yeah,
on.
Just play under the tent. It wouldn't be a bit difficult for us, but, you know, it was mad. And then started and they were just slipping all over the place. Erin Cuthbert went in for a slide tackle and you can see she had a sort of like a carpet burn on her thigh and it just had to stop. But it was just, if they just called it off, no one would have complained, everyone would have understood. But in the end, because we had to play a little bit, it just, everyone looks a bit silly. And
do you think that it was the pressure because it was a BBC, was it BBC One game? It was like a, or was, you know, it was a live
BBC
game.
Two. No, do you know what? People might accuse me of being a company man here, but I spoke actually yesterday to the head of TV football, and he said in these circumstances they really don't put any, they don't say anything because they will be liable. They don't want to put any pressure on. It would have been fine if they'd actually. It's worse because it stopped, and they have to suddenly find something. You know, if they had called it off at 9:30, pop a spring watch or a Holmes under the hammer on, they've got that queued up. But the fact that they had to kind of scramble, they had 2 hours to fill, it's much worse. So actually, no, it's not to do with that.
So Martin Keown saying we should all rip up our licence fee and I'm with him. No.
That's biting the hand that feeds him if he said that.
Yes.
That is true.
No, but if he said it would seem right and people would do it.
Tim says, which of Shrewsbury's 5 goals against Cambridge yesterday was the best in your opinion? I don't need questions like this, Tim. It's outrageous. We're in a spot of bother at the moment. Aaron says, can Jonathan Wilson analyse the Tees Weir derby and his thoughts on both teams' chances for promotion playoff places?
I mean, it's almost impossible to say who's going to get in the playoffs in the Championship. It's, you know, I fundamentally don't want Sunderland to get in them because they're too young and they'd be destroyed in the Premier League. And I think there's something potentially quite beautiful going under Tony Mowbray, and it'd be a shame to have it destroyed by that.
What's growing under him? Is it like a truffle or a fungus?
Well, it's
A documentary I would watch is old Italian men searching for truffles underneath Tony Mowbray.
Del Piero has done something with truffle hunting, hasn't he? What's that?
He has a business, I think.
But I think he's been on an advert. He's advertising Juve's new kit or something.
Yeah, it was a kit launch, according to producer Joel.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't want a kit. I find truffle always makes me gag. I couldn't wear a kit.
It's massively overdone, isn't it? This
it really is. It's overhyped. Yeah.
I think I've told you this story. On my 40th birthday, I overdosed on truffle and I can't touch it anymore.
Like Obelix and the magic potion. How much truffle did you have?
It was the sixth course of a 7-course tasting menu. It was like a truffle cheese with meringue. And I just have to keep on ordering more and more meringue to cut through the truffle. And honestly, the smell of truffle now is enough to make me feel nauseous.
What a decadent moment in a restaurant.
People don't talk about this enough, do they? People don't talk about the problems people have with meringue and truffle. People just overlook it and think it's nothing. You know, that's not something we should be concerned about. But it is. You know, and we're looking at what can happen.
What was the come down like after ODing on truffle? I mean, did you go cold turkey or did you, like... Is there a sort of medicinal? Is there a morphine version of truffle?
Eat some button
mushrooms just to calm it down?
I was in this betting shop in Edinburgh and I'd thrown my last truffles down the toilet and I thought...
James says, is Barry's continuing absence due to him having gone too big for this pod after his solo hit last week? Is there tension in the dressing room? And has his head been turned? Are you expecting approaches for him from other pods before the end of the window? No, he's back on Wednesday. But lots of people have enjoyed the pod that he was on.
So I never said anything about the Tees Weird Derby. Do you want me to say something?
Yeah, go on.
I think the Sunderland were much a better side in the first half. Missed a load of chances. They got a bit lucky with the penalty. I think it was probably just outside the box. When Ross Stewart was brought down by Del Fry, I thought the red card was absolutely right. They scored the rebound from the penalty. Then were really good for about 10 minutes. Middlesbrough came back into it. Sunderland got nervous. And then Ahmed Jallow, who is a magnificent footballer, he's so much better than Sunderland, scores a really, really good second to wrap it up. Both teams are pretty good. I suspect neither is quite good enough to get into the Premier League.
Well, someone's got to get those last two spots in the top six, and there's lots of teams. Some of them must travel to Millwall shortly, which will be a daunting trip and probably a short walk for you.
Will you watch it in the same room, the two of you, in your house now? You live together, or will you?
We followed the Sunderland-Millwall game from the same room in Doha, as Sunderland romped to a 3-0 victory, having been outplayed in the first half.
And did Barney beat the shit out of you after
it? It kicked off big time.
That'll do for today, won't it? Thank you, Robin.
Thanks, Max.
Thank you, the all-new Barney.
Oh, goodbye, everyone. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Wilson.
Cheers, thank you.
We'll be back on Wednesday. Football Weekly was produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens.
This is The Guardian.